The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League chaos on and off and on the pitch at West Ham. Harry Kane's hurt his ankle, a nation holds its breath, and Jamie Vardy scores a belter. In Spain, Sergio Ramos follows through. We'll have a back-heeled volley lob from the edge of the box in Italy and a crazy owner taking a gun on the pitch in Greece. Plus, Old Firm Fit Bar, your questions, feedback corner, a diagnosis murder update, and plenty more on today's Guardian Football Weekly. We have a panel. Greg Bukowski, how are you?
I'm all right, Max. Yeah.
You're in Barry's chair.
I am, yeah. You have big boots to fill, yeah.
Yes, and a sort of unhealthy cough to fill. Yeah, if you can do it mid-interview with Sid, okay. That's when Barry really gets us his loudest coughing. Mark Landon, you were 20 minutes late.
I was, Max, yeah, that London Underground.
Okay, so if the pod comes up late, what's your Twitter handle? People
Max Rushton.
Oh, okay, perfect. Lars Sivertsen.
How you doing?
Some people below the line have been very upset with me asking you what you had for breakfast.
It is nonsensical, isn't it?
Before we've even talked about football, it's a football pod. We shouldn't be doing this.
No, we shouldn't.
Meaningless nonsense about complete what nonsense. You had for breakfast. What did you have for breakfast?
Bit of pizza, Max. I'm a big fan of the big savoury breakfast because like snacking is the enemy, apparently, and I'm very prone to that.
You see, a margarita I could just about see as a breakfast because there are quite a few ham and cheese variants for breakfast. However, if it was a, I don't know, like a spicy beef one, I'm not sure.
Nah, it's just a bit of pepperoni on there.
I think that's fine. No, as long as it's pig, bread, tomato and cheese, that's breakfast, isn't it?
Exactly.
Very good. But hot or cold?
It was warm. Does Barry's absence mean we all have to be like 15% more curmudgeonly than usual just to compensate?
I need one of you to be utterly dour and miserable and appear like you don't care about anything else.
You up for this?
Yeah, I can feel those boots.
Okay, marvellous. Well, let's start in a happy place, the London Stadium. West Ham 0, Burnley 3. But the game is sort of... It's not really about the game, is it? It's just really about the chaos at West Ham. I mean, it was meant to be a game where they remember the 25th anniversary of Bobby Moore's passing, the security failings again. A female steward was knocked to the ground in the crush. Mark Noble threw one of several pitch invaders to the floor. David Sullivan, David Gold were escorted from their seats in the 84th minute. I think a coin hit David Sullivan's glasses, apparently. There are lots of different questions. I suppose question one, Greg, is fans surely, however angry they are, have to take responsibility for their own actions. And if kids are being taken out of football matches and Burnley's players are having to give up their seats in their dugout to keep kids safe, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's horrible. And it's rare to see that level of aggression at a protest mid-match. I mean, sometimes you see that at the end of a match and there's been some thought that's gone into it that other fans will leave and the vociferous fans who want to make the feelings clear are left to make their protest. I think the reason I think this happened is because, and I'm not condoning the behaviour of those fans who were overtly aggressive, is that these fans haven't been listened to, though. And I think they felt, because the protest was called off and they couldn't organise things, the club weren't listening, that this was the only way they could get into the face of the owners, and they clearly got the message across. I'm not, again, not condoning the way they did it, but they probably feel like that's the only way that they could be left to listen to. The fellas who ran around on the pitch, that was just ridiculous. They didn't, I don't know what the point was. Trying to do a Souness thing and put a flag in the middle of a ground that you actively despise is a bit odd, and you feel like you're not on any kind of ownership over it. But I just think this has been brewing for a long time and it's bubbled up at times. And the way the owners have gone about moving everybody to this new stadium where things were supposed to be better, and part of the deal was that, okay, you maybe lose some of your identity, but you get a better team and you get more money, you get players attracted to this brand spanking new stadium, and the owners have still got very little ambition, it appears, and they're still running the club like they were at Upton Park. So the fans now are thinking, well, what was the point in this? And you can't go back.
It's important to say we had quite a long interview on the last pod we did on Thursday about this protest and the different factions involved and whether it was going to happen or not going to happen. The person we interviewed, after we'd finished recording, asked for it to be removed because a number of people have had very specific threats against them from other factions, which it just shows you sort of how toxic it has become.
I think there are two issues here, which are obviously very closely related, but which I want to separate, which is the completely sort of mindless bozos who run onto the pitch for whom we should have zero sympathy, and presumably lifetime bans are coming their way. You'd hope so. But beyond that, there are thousands and thousands of West Ham fans who are rightly upset with the direction the club's been taking. And like I say, it reminds me of that the Alan Davies line about Highbury didn't die for this, you know, when things are going wrong at the Arsenal. And it is, you understand why West Ham fans watch their team and look at the state of their club at the moment and think that Upton Park certainly did not die for that. And I can understand where that frustration comes from.
It's telling that it was Burnley they were playing as well in that game. Burnley look like they're going to finish the best of the rest in the Premier League. That's a position that West Ham probably coveted. You know, try maybe not break into the very, very top, but maybe be the best of the rest of the teams in there. And you've got a team there, a club, maybe 20,000 stadium, fierce sense of identity, a manager with a bit of a long-term... Well, he's got a long-term plan. He might, I don't know how much longer he'll be there, but he has had a long-term plan when he's been there. And they're turning West Ham over at their big, shiny new stadium, and that's a well-run football club.
Yeah, I mean, Burnley's wage bill is so much lower. I mean, it's the lowest, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of the lowest. But the whole thing about moving grounds has kind of become a bit redundant over the last 5 years with the TV revenue. I mean, if you spend... You get so much money coming in, providing you've got a good scouting network, you don't really need the extra money off tickets at the grounds. That might change in the future, but at this moment in time, it hasn't, so...
I spoke to Jacob Steinberg yesterday about it and about how that phrase, oh, this stadium isn't fit for purpose, Mark, I sort of heard it and thought, well, it's just a sort of throwaway cliche. But I think the more and more that these things happen, the more you realise it isn't. For example, with that protest at the directors, there's no other, I can't think of another ground where that could feasibly be possible, whether fans should be or shouldn't be doing it. There's no way you'd have a little platform where they could all congregate. I mean, there are these... You almost need to knock the thing down and build it again.
Well, that was Daniel Levy's idea, wasn't it, for the Olympic Stadium? It's true that the stadium isn't fit for football purpose. I mean, and there's no amount of security, I feel, that could actually deal with the open spaces that there are in certain areas of that. Maybe West Ham should have taken more responsibility for the security. I mean, that's being dealt with elsewhere, isn't it? And I think when West Ham were at Upton Park, all the fans knew the stewards. The stewards were kind of, you know, just their mates, and you know, they weren't even there policing the crowd, if you like. They were, you know, just jolly getting along. It was just, you know, a situation where the stewards were watching the game with the fans, and they kind of felt a connection with each other because they'd just been there so long. And now you've got stewards that are falling asleep. There's that picture of one of them dozing off on Twitter. And the current lot that are in there don't know how to react and handle football fans, no doubt about that.
It's very easy for club owners to think that they are the club because it's their name on the papers and stuff. But, you know, a football club is always more than the team and more than the contracts and the papers and all this. A football club is an institution. It's a tradition, a set of ideas and all of this. And the current owners are never more than the stewards of those traditions, and their job is to run it as well as possibly can be done. And I think there's a very strong case to be made that the current West Ham owners aren't really doing that, and that goes beyond the stadium issues. There was a story doing the rounds before the weekend that while David Moyes' future will be decided by whether they stay up or not, they are allowing him to have a say into who the next sporting director is going to be and hire a few scouts and stuff. And if I'm a fan, that would make my head explode, because player logistics is a long-term thing. That's about building up.
Do you think Moyes will get Fergie in?
But it's such a bizarre thing to do. Like, you're getting the hierarchy all wrong there. I mean, player logistics is about building up a huge database of players to suit the club and blah, blah, blah. And if you have a manager who might not be there in a couple of months, there's nothing to do with him. I mean, this is so weird. And they don't seem to know what they're doing. And that as a fan, would enrage me. And I think they're entitled to be slightly enraged about that.
In the absolute short term, at least they have a manager who's used to kind of managing in a toxic environment in a relegation battle. A very recent experience of that.
That went well, didn't it?
Eddingson says, should Premier League clubs be forced to play the Benny Hill theme over the sound system whenever a fan runs onto the pitch? brackets, this sort of answers itself. And however stupid it sounds, I think it would diffuse.
Yes.
It would immediately diffuse what happens. I mean, the game itself, what's interesting is West Ham could have been or should have been two or three up. Before Burnley opened the scoring, in the first 65 minutes, West Ham had 10 shots, three on target. Burnley had three all off target. Between the 66th minute and the end, Burnley had four on target, the three goals and the one which Chris Wood followed in.
I bumped into a West Ham fan on. I was working at Loftus Road, coming back through sort of a lot of the West Ham fans, and I bumped into a friend who, and I said, "Well, how bad was it today?" He said, "No, we played well for an hour, and it felt like the goal was coming, and you know, we just keep playing the same way." And when I saw the highlights afterwards, they did have chances. Lanzini particularly didn't feel like a 3-0 game really, but the goal from Barnes was absolutely fantastic, and that combined with the toxic atmosphere, you know, West Ham capitulated.
You do wonder if they had been 2 or 3 nil up, if there'd been any sort of protest.
No, there wouldn't have been. No.
That's the case of football, isn't it? Always. Yeah.
But you could say that. But then again, there was obviously a protest planned for before the match, so like we can't put the general unrest down to the match. But of course, it probably wouldn't have kicked off.
It wouldn't have been mid-match, would it?
Yeah, probably not. But but actually, soaking up a lot of pressure and then being ruthlessly efficient is very much the Burnley model, isn't it? If you try to look at the shot,
I forgot you hate Burnley.
Well, no, but they are a strange team, numbers-wise. Like you can never really look at the shot statistics from a Burnley game and try to make sense of it. Like that's not how it works.
Joe Hart was recalled. Mark writes, Hart must have nightmares about Iceland, the team, not the supermarket, after another howler, this time against Goodmanson on Saturday. Isn't it time now just to rule him out of any involvement in the England team?
Yeah, if you were sort of at the London Stadium or watched the game and said, who's the England goalkeeper, you would have pointed at Pope, wouldn't you? Who had another good game. I mean, I don't see how Hart can start at the World Cup. I mean, he's missed most of the season. When he has played, he hasn't performed well. I know there's not that many options, but I just feel like there has to be somebody better, just anybody better.
And if you'd sort of watched Joe Hart over the last couple of years and you didn't know who he was and you just sort of blurred out his face or something so you couldn't see that it was Joe Hart, England goalkeeper, I don't think you'd put him in the England squad, really.
Pep Guardiola got rid of him for a reason. I don't think he wanted to cause arguments. He could see that, you know, technically he's not where he needs to be.
All the chaos took away from the high point of the game, which was Burnley right back Matt Loughton getting one right in the Watsits.
And it was picked up on the microphones quite dramatically, wasn't it?
Oh, the dower sick pain that just arrives 3 minutes later. Anyway.
A word on Ashley Barnes before, if we're going to move on.
Okay, yeah, please do.
What a finish that was. And he's had a few of those this season. You know, he's... I mean, I think he can still play for England, can't he? He's got a couple of under-something caps for Austria, I believe.
But he's played for the under-20s for Austria. But, I mean, given, you know, the crisis of Harry Kane, which we'll get to, then,
it's the
Glenn Murray or Ashley Barnes fight for who leads the line in the World Cup.
I mean, if the World Cup was next week, you'd have to have that discussion, wouldn't you? I mean, what are the options? Are we looking at sort of no-goal Dominic Solanke or something as the other...
And we can do it. We can do it after the Harry Kane chat or the Jamie Vardy, which is a great goal. But let's do Manchester United 2-1 Liverpool. Manchester United are second, 4 points above Spurs, five above Liverpool. Greg, would you like to give them some credit?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think Mourinho got his tactic spot on. I think it really helped him that Liverpool did such a bad job on either doubling up on Lukaku or putting a taller man in Van Dijk on Lukaku, so he didn't dominate Lovren in the way he did early on. And as soon as they scored the first goal, I mean, Liverpool's job became so much harder because United were already deep, but then they could afford to go even deeper and just deny Liverpool's front three any space whatsoever to get in behind. And I mean, Mo Salah, he's had such a quiet game for the last couple of years.
How can Klopp not put Van Dijk on Lukaku?
Well, I think his thinking is that Van Dijk is the footballer at the back. He's also the one who, you know, he can spray the ball around, he can play football, he's a better passer than Lovren. But I do think in that situation, you maybe go with your most dominant player against their most dominant player, or you perhaps he'd instructed the midfielders to help him. I mean, Lukaku was very clever in that he did drop deeper as well, and he gave Love. You could see Love thinking, "Oh, do I go or do I stay here?" And perhaps he could have just stayed, and Lukaku would have flicked it on. You had two men further back.
I think as well, he wants Van Dijk on that left hand side of the two, and so Lukaku just sort of pulled over to that right-hand side, didn't he? As much as him being detailed to mark him, I suppose if he would have gone to the left-hand side, then Van Dijk would have picked him up. But it was probably in United's game plan to get Lukaku up against Lovren wherever possible.
Marcus Rashford, we were just talking about England centre forward, just playing wide. It took the first goal beautifully last night.
Yeah, no, he's really good coming, and especially at coming inside onto his right foot. He's a really good finisher. I think he looks. I understand why there's a clamour to playing up front, but I think he looks better coming in from the left at the moment anyway, and I'm sure he'll mature into a superb centre-forward, but for now he looks more effective coming in there.
You know what he's going to... you know what he's going to do? He's going to cut in, but he can do it so fast that it doesn't matter. Yeah. Like, he can still shift the ball and get a shot away or a cross, so you can't stop him.
Absolutely. But a word on Mourinho, I think, because he does get stick, and understandably so, but when it comes to games like this, identifying the weaknesses of your opponent and nullifying your own weaknesses, there aren't many better in the world at that than he is. He's absolutely superb at analysing the opponents and finding, you know, how can we hurt you and how can we stop you from hurting us. And I mean, they are, I wouldn't say it's fortune because they got it because they were very good, but it obviously suits them very well to get the early goal, because that means they can sit deep, and that is probably something. Liverpool, I think Liverpool are better at it this year than they were last year, but they're still not amazing playing against teams who are sitting deep.
This is the thing. I think for all, you know, Liverpool get loads of plaudits for the way they play. It's exciting, it's vibrant, but they play that one way, and for all that Mourinho gets stick for playing a very, you know, what seems as a dull style of football, they have options to change. They do have options off the bench where they can change the game, whereas Liverpool, once they were 2-0 down, it was like, well, we've got this one way of playing and we'll just have to keep doing that until we maybe get a breakthrough. And they got, you know, a bit of fortune by his own goal, but I think United can change things around a little bit easier.
And this is where, even though they have largely absorbed Coutinho's departure very well, this is the sort of game I think they really could have done with him. And
they improved when Lallana came on.
I was about to say, Lallana.
I mean, you needed some creativity in there, perhaps a little bit earlier than was the case.
Yeah, it's quite interesting if you see how Man United are playing. If Klopp had done something dramatic, like I said, we're just going to do the same thing, you know, go deep and then see what happens. I mean, clearly, basically, you might just have the ball just in the middle of the pitch and no one doing anything.
But I just think there is a reason Liverpool were able to, like when they play Man City, that they were actually able to press them high and hustle them, is because that's what they do every week. That's what they work on. Like, you can't, changing a style of play isn't like flicking a switch. Like, they've worked on this since Klopp arrived, more or less. So actually, of course, Klopp is not an idiot. He will have known if Man United get an early goal, this game is going to be tricky for us. But it's not like he can just tell the players to play completely differently.
It's not unusual for Liverpool to play against teams defending deep at Anfield, but not teams with the caliber of players defending deep like United did at Old Trafford. And you haven't played against that many teams that have been maybe as direct as United were this season either. And I think that could work in United's favour if they go into the Champions League games and play that way. I mean, the very best teams in Europe aren't used to playing against physically dominant sides. Really,
yeah,
anymore.
I mean, and one issue for me was the matchup between Salah and Ashley Young looked like an avenue where Liverpool could really get joy. And Ashley Young was outstanding at left back. And you wonder, we're talking about potential sort of England players, whether Ashley Young, given that Southgate wants to play wing backs, whether Ashley Young sort of, you know, has really forced his way into that England reckoning. The other issue, I suppose, is do Liverpool need a plan B? Because it's often said with Napoli as well, they've got a very similar front three to Liverpool, all small strikers or forward players that, you know, just play that one way. I think Klopp's right to stick to those principles.
Yeah,
and
I understand why he does, because to change from that to something else, seems too drastic. I don't know what a minor change would be. Does, you know, Firmino was slightly taller, maybe. But Solanke, when he comes in, he's just not on the same. It's like he's on a different operating system.
If it's the best way to score a goal in the first minute, I think it's the best way to score a goal in the 90th minute.
Get Crouch back.
There could be an issue of personnel.
Never heard that before, have you?
Like you say, it did change a little bit when Lallana came in, and having a midfielder in there who's comfortable in tight spaces and better at spotting very small gaps and stuff like that, that could help, probably. Mm. And I think, actually, Naby Keita might help the next season, because he's actually very good at just going past people and defending against a deep team. That's very handy.
Kieran says, I considered Lukaku to have bullied Lovren in the derby. What is the worst / best bullying of a player on the pitch you can remember? Does anyone have one?
When that question came through, the one that sprang to my mind was Ibrahimovic against Shawcross when he ended his international career, which lasted 16 minutes. He came on, Ibrahimovic scored a hat. Well, he'd already had one goal, scored another three, and Shawcross never been talked about as playing for England again.
I remember Carragher, who's obviously, you know...
We'll come to that in a second.
We've heard something about him this weekend. Thierry Henry absolutely ripped him apart. I think it was in 2005 at Anfield. Just left him on his arse numerous times. And then the other one, it's a one-off bullying moment, was Ruddick in one swipe breaking both of Andy Cole's legs in a reserve match in 1996. Oh. I remember. And then admitting later on that he did it because Sheringham didn't like him and he's his mate or something.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, as long as he had some principles behind the decision.
I think the ongoing Didier Drogba versus Philippe Senderos thing was quite fun, and that was his sustained bullying, I think, sporting wise. I saw West Brom hero Jonas Olsson once pulled Andy Carroll's ponytail when going up for a header. I thought that was magnificent. More of that.
Greatest bullying is Trevor Benjamin over the entire Sheffield Wednesday team in two legs of the, must have been Rumbelows Cup, I'm going 98, where he scored a goal by just jumping in front of a Kevin Pressman clearance and then scored again at the Abbey. And at the end of the game, Di Canio was so furious to have been beaten by such a terrible team, just sort of threw his boots just onto the floor and just stormed off. In the Champions League, Manchester United played Sevilla 0-0 from the first leg, where Jose got absolutely panned for what was quite a boring game of football. But they should go through, shouldn't they, Greg?
They should go through, and they've now got three very important wins on the bounce. They've got momentum going into that game, and scored seven goals. And I think they're at Old Trafford, and I think they'll be fine. I think that was Sevilla's chance at their place, and they didn't take it. Or De Gea didn't let them take it.
Now, Sevilla actually played quite a strong team at the weekend against Valencia at home and still lost 2-0, so they don't seem to be in like the greatest situation.
They're not a very good side. I don't know why United played them so much respect in the first leg. If United play on the front foot, I think they'll win easily enough.
It's just the home record. They had this incredible home record, so I think that's why Mourinho gave them a lot of respect, but at Old Trafford he won't do.
You mentioned Jamie Carragher. Post-game, there is a video of him spitting after a Manchester United fan starts shouting 2-1 at him. The whole thing is depressing because I think Jamie Carragher is a very good pundit, and the brief meetings I've had with him, he's always been a good guy. But I don't know. I mean, what's he doing? What's he doing? What's the driver doing?
I don't know. I mean, it's inexcusable what Carragher did. When I heard of it this morning, I thought, oh, that seems bad. Then I looked at it and it actually seems worse, because I thought the on-camera provocation may have been worse than what it actually was. I know there's maybe, Carragher said that something, he'd been goaded numerous times. I think it's a depressing thing, and whatever is coming Carragher's way, he's just got to suck it up, really. I think he's still got the lad in him who can't help but react in an aggressive way, it seems, because it just seems over the top. You should know in the position he's in now that's gonna have to deal with that kind of incident.
There's absolutely no way of justifying what Carragher did. I think we all, chatting about it before, agreed there's also no way of justifying somebody who's driving down a road filming someone rather than concentrating on the road, which is illegal anyway. Also, as soon as his daughter says, Jamie Carragher spat on me, he didn't seem to care that his daughter had been spat on. He just you could just hear the cogs whirring in his mind that he could make some money out of this. And as producer Jonathan says, weird, why don't you just, if you're going to send that video, cut it before you start, before all that thing comes out. I mean, anyway.
I've looked this up now. It is illegal to hold a phone or sat nav while driving or riding a motorcycle. And I've looked through the laws here. There is, in fact, not a caveat where it says it's okay if you are goading a man off the telly and trying to film it to get a holiday out of it or something. I mean, there is no caveat for that for people out there. They're just, that's
smartphones have made morons of us all. Like, I think. I've just lost mine, so I'm having a good moment at the moment.
Breaking news that we all knew was going to happen. Scott McTominay has been called up for Scotland for their friendlies against Costa Rica and Hungary. So well done to him. And he played okay, didn't he? Actually, Pogba not being there seemed to free up Manchester United. I know it's always about Paul Pogba, so I'm loath to do another 10 minutes on it. Lars, you seem to want to do another 10 minutes on it.
You do get the sense, if you stick a gun to Jose Mourinho's head and say, like, for a big game you have to pick either Scott McTominay or Paul Pogba for this position, I swear to God, I think he'd go McTominay. I really do. Because it's just because of the system, the way Mourinho sets his team up. And like we said, that's not necessarily like being putting him down or anything. He's extraordinarily good at doing that. And he's won so many trophies doing it. But you kind of do need the players to do exactly what the manager's telling them to do. And Pogba doesn't really do that. And it's so frustrating to him.
Yeah, he'll always choose the player who will say, yes, boss.
Exactly.
Right, Spurs won 4-1 at Bournemouth. But Harry Kane turned his ankle. Dele Alli went off injured. Danny Rose went off injured as well. There's a scan today. Obviously, all the papers are going, Kane could miss the World Cup. The end of England's chances. we were going to win it before Kane did his ankle. Bruce says, given how much Spurs improved after Kane went off injured and his shocking record in important games for club and country, do you think England would be better off without him? Mark?
No.
No,
I mean, it could actually work in England's favour if Kane was to miss, I don't know, 6 weeks or maybe a little bit more. He'd have that breather. I mean, he'd been on the go when he disappointed in the last European Championship and also the under-21s before that. I mean, he's been on the go a long time, playing up front, you know, with very little rotation in that Tottenham team. So maybe a break now could be for the best for England, not for Tottenham, obviously, even though they did improve as a team when he went off. I don't think it was because Kane went off that they improved. It was that they got to grips with the game and you know, gradually got into it. So, you know, you'd always rather have Kane in the side than not.
Spurs' first win this season after going behind, which is quite a surprising statistic. We were just talking about Ashley Young and whether he would play the part. You watched Danny Rose getting done by Adam Smith for pace. I mean, I don't know how fast Adam Smith is, but he's never struck me as someone who was particularly quick. He does look a shadow of the player that he was before he got injured.
He does, but I'd like to give Spurs some credit here, because, like, okay, Bournemouth is a team they should be beating, and I think Spurs, you see where they drop points this season, it tends to be against teams who sit really deep, because they also have this problem because they like attacking and having space to run into, so they've dropped points to like West Brom and just nonsense like this. But Bournemouth, because they play quite an open game, you'd expect them to win that quite casually. But they started really badly, Spurs. They could have been 2-0 down within the first couple of minutes. They had that quite traumatic exit from the Champions League. You lose Kane to injury, and suddenly that game becomes a real test of their mettle. And I think if they were the, you know, mentally frail, you know, bedwetters they've been made out to be by certain people, I don't think they'd come back and win that game. And they did, you know, they did get down to it and recorded quite a casual win in the end. And there's the thing to be said for that.
Mark, do we worry for Bournemouth? No win in four. They're 12th on 33 points.
I think they'll stay up because of their quality going forward. You know, I thought that Stanislas and you know, Callum Wilson did cause Tottenham a lot of problems in that first half. And yes, they are going to, you know, try to trade blows with just about anybody. And I mean, against the best teams, that they've won at Chelsea, beat Arsenal, but more often than not, playing that way, I think you will get beat and beat easily. But against kind of the teams around them at home, I think that they'll pick up enough points playing that way. I was quite impressed with Moussa as well, actually. I hadn't seen him play too often, and I don't think the Bournemouth fans have either, but he caused Spurs some problems with his pace as well. So no, I think they'll be okay, Bournemouth.
Asmir Begovic has played every minute for Bournemouth, and his form is, it's just interesting, isn't it? Because he just sort of had this image of being an absolutely brilliant purchase, and doesn't seem to be delivering as much as
we expected. Had a bad game yesterday, that's for sure. I've never been totally convinced by him. I do think as well, maybe being on the bench at Chelsea for so long kind of knocked the rhythm out of him. I always think that goalkeepers doing that should be your last career move, to go and be a reserve a big club like that, rather than when you're supposed to be sort of heading into your peak.
Chelsea are fifth. 2-1 win over Palace. Four defeats in a row now for Crystal Palace after those last-minute defeats to Spurs and Manchester United. This was more straightforward. They've got some more winnable games, though. Huddersfield, Bournemouth and Brighton in their next four, as well as Liverpool. Chelsea go to Barcelona on Wednesday. Anyone give them hope, Chelsea?
No, I think the away goals sort of knock the stuffing out of them.
Yeah, no.
Lars, give some hope to the Chelsea fans listening, saying, why have you not spoken for a long time about our club in this podcast?
I would say that I'd be very hesitant to rule out Conte in terms of setting up a team tactically and prepare them correctly for a game like this. It's not a good situation, like, because of the away goal, of course, and Barcelona are a much better team than they are, I'd say, but... I wouldn't bet the house against Conte in any game that's still in the balance, because he is a very, very smart guy. And the atmosphere perhaps at Chelsea isn't ideal, because everyone kind of knows that he's going and the players seem to be a bit bored with it all. So that's not the best situation for them to be in. But I think there's still hope, for sure.
All right, that'll do for part one. We'll be back in part two, where we'll begin with Jamie Vardy's brilliant volley. Welcome back to part two. Before we talk about the football, if you are in and around Belfast or Copenhagen, come and watch us do our live shows. April the 17th in Belfast, May the 10th in Copenhagen. You're Scandinavian, Lars.
Yeah.
Will that be fun?
Probably.
Great.
Copenhagen's a fun city. It's one of not too many big, proper fun cities in Scandinavia, because it's quite small.
It's on the day of the Danish Cup final. Ooh, so you could go to both. Saucy. I hope we've timed it right. You can go to both, can't you? Cup final and then a live show. Come along, pay the money, enjoy it. And yeah, great. Right, let's move on. West Brom 1, Leicester 4. Before we talk about how doomed West Brom are, can we just marvel at the Jamie Vardy goal?
Brilliant.
Mahrez sees him going, hits a perfect pass over the shoulder on his wrong foot volley. Mm. Technically, I'm not sure if there's a harder goal to score.
No, so difficult. Because he had to be looking at the ball the whole time, so, and he's still running, so he can't see where the goal is anymore. He's just doing that off instinct. And then it comes over his shoulder. He doesn't absolutely wallop it. He has to kind of just guide it into the corner, which he does fantastically well. And it was the kind of thing, I've seen Suarez do something similar, and that's the kind of calibre of skill level that was involved in him scoring that goal. And also, it very much reminded me of Leicester title-winning season goal with Mahrez's inch-perfect pass from quite a deep area.
And this might sound bonkers, but I still get the sense that there's a slight sort of snobbery with regards to Jamie Vardy still. Like, he's a guy who's scored all these goals through trying extremely hard and just being a bit nasty and nipping at people's heels and blah, blah, blah. But that is a proper world-class finish, and we've seen quite a few of them.
I suppose the issue with Jamie Vardy, isn't it, we're talking about Kane's injury, is when England play, they will come up against defences who are sitting deep, and midfield that's sitting deep as well. And Vardy is at his absolute best when he's got a run. And if there's no space in behind...
Nobody to give the ball to him the way that Mahrez can as well would be another issue, I think, with the England midfield.
I do completely agree with that, but I also think you do need, in games like that, you need a forward who can, I mean, absent a big, powerful number nine who can just bully everyone physically, and I don't think there is one like that at the moment. And I'm not counting Andy Carroll here. Having someone who's that good, a natural finisher, who can whip off a shot and just no space at all, and just who's so deadly when he's on form, I think is not a bad thing.
Well, the problem I'd see with it is that a lot of the England team is going to comprise of, you know, Spurs players, some Liverpool players, not many Leicester players, and probably just Vardy, I guess. And the style of football they play, the England defence... generally now he's used to trying to play out from the back, whereas to play a little bit more direct is what would suit Vardy, so they'd have to kind of drum that into those players, I think, before they went, that they need to be able to play a different way maybe to how they do with the clubs.
West Brom, are they done now?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, but I also think, like, two games ago, they missed a trick in not just bringing in any old manager just to say they've lost it. Like, they've already lost, so they've got just a series of L's in the form table. Anyone, just bring anybody in and just see if you can get some kind of reaction. And they've left it very, very late now. I mean,
yeah, that time's passed now. Do you think?
Well, I don't know. There's still eight games left. I think this season's made it very difficult to judge. In years gone by, with eight games left, you could still perhaps get two or three wins, and you're back up there.
But I mean, the fans love Gary Megson, and I mean, he did okay when he was caretaker. In that short period between Pulis and Pardew coming in, he got the point at Tottenham, and the fans really would get behind him at least. I mean, the players have clearly given up for Pardew. Krakowiak kicked off after being substituted and wouldn't shake Pardew's hand at the incident in Barcelona as well. I mean, I'm amazed that he's still there. You've got to try something to stay up, and that seems like the only option left.
I enjoyed Pardew's interviews after the game, because I thought he spoke with the relaxed confidence of a man who knows the absolute worst thing that can happen to him, that he gets paid a lot of money to go on holiday indefinitely. You know, it is a bad situation there. But is he really the guy that you want to rebuild and get them back up from the Championship? Like, I'm not convinced of that at all. So, but maybe, I don't know, maybe there's like a break clause in the summer in his contract, and maybe it's cheaper to get rid of him then.
They just get another manager in the summer, and whoever it takes the job now, if they do get shut apart, he's just a caretaker, just someone who's going to rattle the sabre and see if they can get anything out of the players. Maybe even just go back, say, remember how you were playing on the pool list? Maybe do that again, because at least you could defend a bit then.
So come on, eight games. What, Dave Bassett?
Buddy Glendening?
Harry Redknapp? It could be Harry, you know, just someone to get him going.
Just sign loads of players when you're not looking. And it's just...
Do you know what? It doesn't, honestly, doesn't matter now. Like, it really doesn't.
This could be the one chance to give it to a load of journalists to see if they actually know anything about
Kerbs,
football.
Where's Kerbs?
Apparently, there is a break clause at the end of the season.
That would make sense then.
West Brom have scored first in 12 of their games this season. Three wins. I mean, that's a damning statistic. Mm.
And two of those were the opening two games of the season. So, I mean, one win.
There was a moment on this pod where we were going, will West Brom win every game this season 1-0 and win the league?
The amazing thing is that they knocked Liverpool out of the FA Cup at Anfield. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. And they played really well on that occasion.
I am a Solomon Rondon truther. I mean, West Brom fans would hurl rotten fruit at me if I said that in their presence, I'm sure. But I still think there's a player in there somewhere. But he needs maybe more chances than he's being served today.
Stoke are second bottom. They play Manchester City tonight. I got told off on the wireless for suggesting that Stoke would take a 1-0 defeat right now. Their goal difference, I think, is the worst in the Premier League.
Yeah, -26. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm. But you think
a lot of teams would take it with 1-0 defeat against City.
Chelsea did.
Hey,
I mean, they lost 7-2 at the Etihad. I mean, I was trying to make a sense. It's not a stupid point, or is it?
It's hard. It's hard in a home game to go in with that mentality. I mean, I think after the game, maybe Paul Lambert, if they've played quite well and lost 1-0, you can accept that. But seven of their 14 defeats have been by at least three goals.
I think Benitez is kind of the blueprint for how to play against Man City, in that just stay in the game. So you're right to an extent. Stay in. You concede a goal, you're losing 1-0. Still try to lose 1-0. Still try to lose 1-0 until the 88th minute, and then try and nick something. And Newcastle almost did that up at St James's
and
Park.
And actually, the Newcastle fans were right behind it, weren't they? They cheered every kick and every foul and everything that wasn't a Man City
goal.
Yeah,
and loads of pundits and the press had a go at Benitez for going into the game that way, saying that's what's wrong with the Premier League. No one's willing to have a go at Man City. But had he done so, they could have been on the end of a 5-0 wallop. So I think that's the way to go about it. I'm sure Lambert is clever enough to know that that's the way they should do it. Although their defence, it's everything that Pulis's Stoke defence wasn't these days.
Yeah, I suppose it's the sort of game you don't expect to get anything from it. But so if you're not expecting anything in terms of results, you are playing in front of your own fans, so you just got to give them something to... I mean, fans are not stupid. They'll see your team playing Man City and they're not expecting you to get much out of it, but if you at least show a bit of fight and give them something to say, accept that, you know, we went down swinging, then, you know...
Yeah, but there's an argument to rest all their players and save it for Everton on Saturday, where
they did that at Chelsea, and then Mark Hughes absolutely killed it.
That was the end of Hughes, wasn't it?
Well, no, because he rested all his players and then they lost the next game, didn't they?
If that game was in a couple of days, then fair enough, but they've got quite a long way to go into the weekend, I think.
Yeah, I was just trying to... You know.
Resting all the players and losing like 12-0 is probably not going to do anything for their prospects.
Southampton remain one place above the relegation zone, comprehensively beaten 3-0 by Newcastle. It was a lovely tweet of St James's Park from quite far away, the sound when Kennedy scored after 2 minutes. And actually, a brilliant goal.
Like
that chest, I'm a big fan of the chest.
The bouncy
football.
Fellaini style, kind of big bouncy chest.
Chested up and turned and scored. Matt Ritchie's side foot pass was beautiful as well.
It was, yeah. He's been such a good signing on loan from Chelsea. I mean, he offended a billion people, didn't he, at the beginning of the season, which is why he's just been cast out by Chelsea. But like we were saying before, people make mistakes on social media. Barry Glendening does it very regularly. He's still around, isn't he?
That'll come back to bite when you do something stupid on social media.
Oh, yeah. And he's, I think Benitez has seen that he is a player who is obviously a level above Newcastle, but because of his misdemeanors, he needs to find somewhere to play football again. And he's gone and brought him into Newcastle, and his touch is great. He's got that rare blend of very high skill level and an insatiable work rate as well. And I think that's really made the Newcastle fans take to him. And he was fantastic. But for Newcastle were, you know, kind of followed suit. They were just terrorizing Southampton's players whenever they were on the ball, and just it was just so good, so good at kind of pressing them at the right moments. But he's been a very good signing, and Southampton just looked like a daddy long legs just bouncing around the room with doing not very much and showing no threat level whatsoever. And Pellegrino, I spoke to him very early on in the season. He's such a zen like character, and that's probably what you really don't need in a situation like this, which is a relegation dogfight now, because he just seems like he's not getting anything out of the players anymore, other than just passing it around neatly and going nowhere.
One win in 17 for Southampton, Mark. Their squad looks like it should be quite good.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, the manager seems to have completely lost his way. I'm not sure what the plan ever was, really. They've never looked like a team with an identity trying to work towards something. Obviously, the lack of forward options in terms of who they trust to play up front, because he doesn't like Gabbiadini. Long doesn't score enough goals. Carrillo's come in. I mean, it's asking a lot of a young player.
Well, it worked when Charlie Austin was there, and then he got injured. And he was like the last option. He kind of held off playing Charlie Austin for so long that the fans were really angry. And then he started playing him, started scoring goals. Then he got injured, and then he went back to the way they were playing before, which was just absolute toothless football.
If you swap those managers over, there's no way Newcastle win that game 3-0.
No, and it's interesting. Benitez. I mean, Pellegrino is a student of Benitez. He's worked under him, and he's played under him, and he professed about having, you know, taken a lot of his ideas into the way he goes about management, but it's very, very different in the way that Benitez actually makes it. You can see what Newcastle are all about. They don't lose games because they're a shambles. They lose them because the players aren't as good as the opposition usually, and that's not the case for Southampton, because they've got better players than...
And I think Pellegrino's getting away with it, maybe because of where they are sort of regionally. If this was a London club performing this badly under, you know, in the spotlight, say West Ham without the board issues, I mean, there would be big calls, I'm sure, for the manager to go. And the Southampton fans want him out, but they're not really being listened to.
After 12 matches as well, he was already saying, you know, nothing ever lasts forever in management. And, you know, you never expect to be around that long. It's like, well, what are the players making of that when you hear the manager like talking in that way?
Possibly, you know,
it's very honest, but it's also, you just don't say that kind of stuff.
You know how
publicly.
Jonathan Wilson says goals are overrated? Perhaps Pellegrino's looked at that and said, all I want to do is play really lovely, sort of stylish football, but just keep ball. Play keep ball, and then, you know, we'll concede at some point, and we obviously won't score. It's a whimper, isn't it? Like, of all the sides that you're right, Mark, there's no clamour. There's just absolutely nothing. Huddersfield 0, Swansea 0. Early sending off for Jordan Ayew after 11 minutes for a lunge on Jonathan Hogg. Match of the day, Frank Lampard, who increasingly is becoming he was a great player. He seems to be one of the best.
He's really sharp,
really on it. Seems to say sensible things. Was saying that they both should have got sent off. And actually, when you first see the challenge, you think, he's got to go. And then we see it again, you see, actually, yes, they both lunged two-footed. He's just lunged a bit higher.
Mm.
So they both could have gone. But the stats for this game are just brilliant.
They're brilliant, yeah.
30 attempts for Huddersfield, naught for Swansea. Passes completed in the attacking third. 272 Huddersfield, 11 by Swansea. Danny Williams came on with 20 minutes to go, completed more passes than all but two of the Swansea team. That's a great defensive performance from Carlos Carvalho, isn't it?
And their expected goals were 0.00.
Huddersfield's possession was 80.84, and that's Huddersfield, who don't play a possession game. So, and that, I think that's the second highest in Premier League history. And they drew 0-0. And Fabianski was fantastic in goal for Swansea, as were the defenders. And they've drawn, I think Swansea have drawn 6 or 7 games 0-0 this season. So
Wagner was, I thought he was quite good after the game, though, because he realised that Huddersfield had played quite well and done enough to win the game, the woodwork twice. And he's somebody that you can feel he's not panicking in the situation. During that game, it would have felt must win for Huddersfield, you know, to really dent a relegation rival. But after the game, he was quite calm. And I kind of trust that if Huddersfield are to get out of it, Wagner sort of has got a way to do that.
He seems like a very smart guy. And surely he knows that being 15th at this point of the season, I mean, they would have absolutely bitten the head off of that before the season started if they could take it. You know, it's... We talk about Burnley having a small wage bill. I mean, we don't have the figures for Huddersfield this year, but that's going to be way down. I'd be surprised if there were a bigger underdog in this league anytime recently. You know, the fact that they're not completely marooned at the bottom of the table at this point is incredibly impressive.
Arsenal beat Watford 3-0 in one of those sort of pointless games. Petr Cech's 200th clean sheet, which he'd been trying to get for about 250 years, it seemed. He saved Troy Deeney's penalty. Karma after Troy Deeney's cojones comment in the return fixture. We should mention Arsenal's win over AC Milan because no one on the pod predicted it. You're all blameless because you weren't here.
I wouldn't have predicted it.
Did any of you see that coming?
No.
I mean, Milan won again on Sunday, so it goes to show it wasn't an excellent victory for Arsenal. I didn't see it at all.
Although Arsenal do have this habit. I mean, last season they did it. He recovered after what seemed like a defeat at Crystal Palace that would see the end of Wenger and from which they wouldn't be able to kind of... The players would be too distraught to come back from. And that seemed the case at Brighton, and then they've beaten Milan, they've beaten Watford, and now you just wonder, is this it? All the eggs in one basket for the Europa League? Do they win that and get into the Champions League? And Wenger just stands back and says, admire my kind of equivalent of fourth place.
Mkhitaryan's through ball for Aubameyang to go around the goalkeeper and score is something that maybe will give Arsenal fans a bit of hope for next season, that is a combination that's worked before, could work again. I mean, we spoke about Benitez earlier. I mean, I can't believe he's not in the conversation for next Arsenal. I think he would be a fantastic appointment for somebody like Arsenal.
Particularly that the teams have been crying out for like resilience for the last 10 years, and he's a manager who can give you that without maybe the sparkling football that they've been used to. But surely that's what hasn't been working for them, trying to play the sparkling football hasn't worked now for quite some time.
And actually, in mind games fun, Benitez to be in one of those top six against all the others would be quite fun, wouldn't it? Everton beat Brighton 2-0. Missed penalty in this game as well. Rooney's, even though Leighton Baines was on the pitch, it didn't matter though. Cenk Tosun and an own goal from Gaten Bong. And the fun bit was Bong's reaction, where he basically looked up as if it was nothing to do with him. I mean, it wasn't like a comedy own goal, but he was still definitely slightly responsible because it hit him and went in, and he gave this look of, what do you expect? I mean, what am I going to do? Which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Also, Knockhart sending off. It was really odd because Leighton Baines saw it coming and he was just like, I'm just going to stand here. And he kind of bounced off his shin and then he just looked down at him.
It was so Sunday League in that when you're on the pitch and people get raged, basically someone had just punted the ball into his face, hadn't they?
Yeah.
And he was still, it was Baines, but it he was still really annoyed about somebody accidentally punting the ball in his face.
It was just really embarrassing because he looked down at him and said, well, that was a really crap two-footed tackle. And then he got Coleman kind of going over and having a word with him.
Yeah.
He knows about a bad tackle or two. It was an odd game. And then that's Everton in a nutshell as well, that they can kind of get these wins at home, but away from home they're absolutely dreadful.
But if you're knockout, what are you doing? It's 10 minutes left of a game you've lost, and you're half decent player that the team's going to need in the relegation battle. Like, what are you thinking?
Some people,
one of the weirdest challenges of the year, I think it is, all things considered.
Why Brighton are 11th? I had a look at their remaining fixtures. They've still got to play all of the top four, and they've only got two matches against teams currently below them. So 11th looks very safe with so few games left, but you just wonder how many more points they can actually collect. I think they've got a couple of really big home games, but not going to get too many against those big four.
Is it possible that those games come when those big four have nothing to play for, or not?
It's a mixture of those, but I think the way the top four battle is going, okay, Man City will have the league wrapped up by then, but you know, the other games could still be a scrap.
I think
for the
it's going to go. It's going to go pretty much to the wire, I think, because as long as Chelsea stay in touch, there's going to be no wriggle room for the teams above them.
Fitbar corner, a Barry-less Fitbar corner, but we can still talk about the old firm. I don't know if any of you saw it. It was an absolute cracker. Celtic won 3-2, despite Rangers being ahead twice, Celtic being down to 10 men when they scored the winner. They're now 9 points clear with the game in hand. So had Rangers won this, the title race would have definitely been alive. In the 87th minute, Rangers' Alfredo Morelos hit the post. People use that phrase with the goal at his mercy, but they really mean it on this occasion. It was quite amazing that he managed to hit the post. But some credit to Rangers for making a season of things when I think nobody expected it, Mark.
Well, they started badly, didn't it, with that Europa League defeat was in Luxembourg. They have improved since Murty became manager, but it's still a big gap. The fact that you mentioned it, down to 10 men, still couldn't, you know, win the game at Celtic. And I don't think it does them any favours when they're looking at the bigger picture of Europe. It needs Rangers to get even stronger, I think, for Celtic to improve more.
You and Muddy was talking Rangers up after that game, saying that they've had a decent season and next season they could improve and really make a go of it. I think what could have a key part in that is if Rodgers is to leave Celtic in the summer, he has taken them on to another level from when he took over, and whoever comes in, can they continue that dominance? And if they can't, then I think other Rangers and perhaps other sides as well will see a chance to bridge the gap to Celtic.
In the Football League, Wolves are stuttering. One win in their last five, beaten 4-1 by Steve Bruce's Aston Villa at the weekend. Villa now third. Six wins in a row in the Championship for Cardiff. 3-2 over lowly Birmingham. Cardiff were 3-0 up in that. And Fulham won again. 2-1 at Preston. Alexander Mitrovic with another two goals. Fine scoring run he's on, including a last-minute winner in that game. Derby and Middlesbrough make up the playoff places. Derby another game without a win, though. They're on a shocking run. 0-0 at Forest in the Cluffy Cup, while Borough beat Barnsley 3-1. The most fun game was at Hull, where four penalties were scored, including three in 23 first-half minutes, as they beat Norwich 4-3. The first in England's top four tiers to see four penalties awarded since Man City Spurs on the 18th of October 2014. Hull came back from 3-1 down, and Sunderland remained bottom, had a man sent off after 49 minutes, lost 1-0 at QPR. Were you there, Mark?
I was there, and I mean, everything that people say about Sunderland is true. They are as bad a side as I think you can possibly get in the Championship. Didn't register a shot on target. It was an awful, awful game. The red card for Steele was hilarious. He came out to clear the ball, which bounced over his head. He then handballed it outside of the area, was rightly sent off, and then 10 minutes later, QPR scored with virtually their first chance, and that was that.
Wow, that sounds like a terrible game of football.
At half-time, I looked at my notes and there was virtually nothing written down. And then I checked the stats. There was not a shot on or off target from either team in the first 45 minutes.
Was there any part of you that wanted to leave?
I always feel that you should never complain about being paid to watch football. And I always sort of take that kind of moral point. You know, the people around you have paid 30-odd quid or whatever to watch this. But yes, you're right. I did wonder what I was doing there.
Whether you were actually watching football or not.
Well, yeah, that's a
philosophical question.
Yeah. It wasn't football like we know it, that's for sure.
I suppose they're a cautionary tale, Sunderland, if you're a fan of a Premier League club. Let's call them West Ham. And you think your club is so horrendously badly run that maybe relegation would be a good thing. Maybe it isn't. Maybe look at Sunderland and actually it isn't actually a good thing at all.
The goalkeeper Steele was kind of jeered off by the Sunderland fans when he was making that lonely walk down the tunnel. Ashley Fletcher, the striker, was cheered and then booed when he was substituted. So there's a real kind of, quite right as well, I think, the real frustration from the travelling fans.
Well, any West Ham fans who thought it was bad, Lars, you've now made them feel even worse, oh, which is nice.
That's what I'm here for.
In League One, straightforward home wins for Blackburn and Shrewsbury means it's as you were at the top. Steve Evans won his first game in charge of filthy Peterborough. In League Two, Accrington Stanley, the new leaders, they won at Luton, who had been top since November. Last-minute winner from Billy Key. Kev Nolan's Notts County a third. They won at Forest Green. Wickham conceded a 93rd-minute equaliser at home to the mighty Cambridge. And that'll do for part two. We'll start part three in Spain with Sid. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid on the landline. How are you, Sid Lowe?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, excellent. You're about an octave higher on your landline, interestingly. Maybe this is your real voice. Gareth asked this question about Sergio Ramos. Does he use 3-ply triple thickness toilet paper after his accident on the pitch on Saturday?
Yeah, the answer to that is he uses whatever toilet paper is available at Ipurua when, of course, he's not using his Real Madrid shorts. For those who don't know, this was at the weekend. There's a moment in the second half when Ramos kind of sidles up to the referee, at which point the referee should really kind of sidle away again, going, Jesus, take a step back, will you? And he says, ref, I need to go, as in really need to go. So he runs off the pitch. He's gone for about 4 minutes, and then he comes back on and carries on playing. After the game, Zinedine Zidane was asked what happened with Sergio Ramos, and Zidane, as direct and as blunt as you like, said he crapped himself a little bit and had to go to the bathroom.
Well, perfectly said by Zidane, isn't it? How was the game itself?
Actually, the game was quite good. I mean, and in a way, you sort of expect it to be because Eibar are a really good side. I mean, they're the tiniest team in the first division by a very long way. They've got a stadium that holds about 7,000. You know, they're only in their fourth ever season in the first division, and yet they're competing for a European place. They get the ball in the box loads. They put a lot of pressure on you. What that tends to mean against the bigger clubs is that then teams find a way through them, whether it's on the counter-attack or whether it's robbing the ball off them and running. And that's what happened. Cristiano Ronaldo scored twice, both of them really quite nice assists. The second, a great cross. And the first, an absolutely gorgeous pass from Luka Modric with the outside of the foot, which, by the way, was something Rafa Benitez kept telling him not to do.
Really? That's like classic Modric.
Yeah, Rafa actually told him to stop playing the ball with the outside of his foot.
Barca warmed up for Chelsea with a 2-0 win at Malaga, seventh defeat in a row for them.
Yeah, Malaga are dreadful, and they're more or less gone now. It would take something very, very special now to turn it around, and there's no real sign of any kind of reaction from them. For Barcelona, it was relatively comfortable. They were without Leo Messi, who was off being a father for the third time, but they played pretty well, Barcelona, and I think the most striking thing, and certainly the thing that most Barcelona fans have kind of grabbed hold of, is the fact that Dembélé played really, really well, and it's been quite difficult first season for him so far between injuries and a kind of a sense that he doesn't feel entirely comfortable in his role, or maybe even just entirely comfortable in Barcelona full stop, and yet he played really, really well, and he had the personality to go at people. And afterwards, Valverde said, look, he's got those kind of qualities, he's got that ability that we're going to need. And of course, the question that everyone's asking is, does he mean against Chelsea? I suspect not, to be honest with you, but it's not totally out of the question that he starts against Chelsea.
And from the Sevilla game, they lost 2-0 to Valencia, potentially the worst attempt to get a fellow professional footballer sent off.
It's brilliant,
ever.
Isn't it?
It's totally joyous. Talk us through it.
You've got two players in front of you. I believe it's two, not just one. And because they're running, of course, their elbows are going backwards. So what you do is you sort of dive forward at kind of waist level and effectively try and headbutt their elbows as they're going backwards to make it look like you've been assaulted.
Yeah, Zaza, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Zaza went... I mean, it's, And he doesn't get hit either. Like he doesn't.
No, he doesn't even catch him. So he didn't even get that bit right.
But then he still goes down. I mean, it's just. I mean, you absolutely have to go on Twitter or YouTube, whatever. Just type in Zaza and it'll come up. It's absolutely brilliant. There are stories of members of the PSG board flying to Brazil to try and ward off Neymar going to Madrid. Do you know any more, Sid?
No, I mean, look, what's obviously been taken as read a lot in Spain is that at some stage he'll end up back at Real Madrid. But, you know, this is a Paris Saint-Germain. This is a club that doesn't need to sell players, that loses an enormous amount of face if they do so, and will ask for ludicrously large amounts of money. Now, what could happen? They could try and encourage him and persuade him to stay, but they could also do what they did with Verratti in the summer, which is just say, tough shit, mate, you're staying here. End of story. You've got a contract. It's different, of course. And this is a kind of a key point, which I think hasn't been missed in Spain. It's different, of course, with Spanish players, because Spanish players, contractually and by law, all have buyout clauses. So, in other words, even if the price is absurdly high, if someone comes in and offers it, you have to let them go. That's just not the case with Paris Saint-Germain's players. It is with players in Spain, which, of course, is why Paris Saint-Germain could buy Neymar in the first place, because at €222 million, Barcelona thought that his buyout clause was a deterrent. In fact, it was actually quite attractive.
What do you think will happen?
I think, my feeling is that at some stage he will agitate for a move. I don't necessarily think it'll happen yet. At some stage he will push very hard for it, and then it will be a question of resolve. But I feel like if Paris Saint-Germain don't want to lose face badly, and something that's as kind of politically driven as this, and as important how they're seen, I mean, if I was them, I would just say to him, no, tough luck, you stay. And you know what? Seeing as we've got money to burn, if you really, really, really do want to kick up a sting, all right, you sit and stay, and you don't train, you don't play. Tough luck.
When Qatar decides that you're going to stay and work, you usually stay and work.
Yeah. I'm surprised they haven't taken his passport off him, to be honest.
Sid, thanks as always.
Pleasure.
Cheers, Sid Lowe, out in Spain, from Spain. Yes, Lars?
I have a lovely mental image now of just PSG board members roaming the Brazilian countryside with pitchforks, sort of looking for Real Madrid people who are there to entice Neymar in some way. I think that'd be good. That'd make a good film.
Yeah. Who would star?
I don't even know.
From Spain, let's go to Italy. No Barry for the Piazza, so here's Paolo Bandini.
This was an emotional weekend in Italy, as Serie A returned to action for the first time following the death of Davide Astori. There were tributes paid to the Fiorentina captain all over the country, but as you can imagine, the most emotional of those took place at the Stadio Artemio Franchi. The Viola's entire first-team squad, plus coaches, came out wearing his number 13 shirt before kickoff against Benevento. And in the 13th minute, the ball was deliberately kicked out of play so that everyone could share in a minute's applause. Fiorentina went on to win 1-0, and in one of those fitting twists, it was actually the man replacing Astori, Victor Hugo, who also happened to be wearing his shirt number in reverse, the number 31, who scored the only goal of the game. For all the emotion involved in the game, and you could certainly see how much it meant to Fiorentina's players at the end when they essentially all collapsed as one, it was also a pretty fiercely contested game because Benevento are fighting against relegation and wound up hitting the post in the 88th minute, which gives you some indication of how hard they were pushing. And I think in many ways that was indicative of a weekend which sort of began with tributes but also very quickly re-engaged with the business that's going on at both ends of the table. Juventus took sole possession of first place for the first time all season as Napoli were held by Inter. Milan edged closer to the top floor with a last gasp win at Genoa, and Crotone, who'd been fighting against relegation, suddenly out of nowhere battered Sampdoria 4-1. You also had what I believe is undoubtedly the goal of the season, scored by Lazio's Ciro Immobile, a volleyed backheel lob from the edge of the area, which earned them a point away to Cagliari in the 95th minute, so look that one up. But Roma, meanwhile, also with a really big result, winning 3-0 on Friday night against Torino, which tied them hold on third place, but perhaps more importantly, in a game where they had both Federico Fazio and Edin Dzeko suspended, setting them up nicely for Tuesday's Champions League last 16 tie against Shakhtar. They obviously lost 2-1 away in the first leg, so they've got it all to do in the second.
Thanks, Paolo. And yeah, if you haven't seen the Immobile finish, I mean, after you've gone on YouTube to see Zaza trying to get sent off for headbutting someone's elbow, the Immobile volley is just beautiful, isn't it?
It's my favourite type of goal in the sense that it's a really stupid thing to try.
Yeah.
Like when you're one goal down and you're 5 minutes into injury time, this is the time for the back heel lob from the edge of the area. You know, you should be slapped for even attempting that. But obviously, when it goes in, it is the goal of the season.
A time now to go to Lukas Podolski's kebab shop, Lars, and that's you with the German news.
Ein Deutscher Fußball Rundfunk.
Ah, okay. Rundfunk is a great word.
All right, so Bayern absolutely smashed Hamburg. You may even say that Hamburg were ground into a patty, fried, and then eaten. I think that works.
I see you've got a scriptwriter in to do this, Lars. I can't wait to hear more.
My dog's written this. In their last three visits to Munich, Hamburg have conceded 21 goals. They clearly don't like going there, either that or they like it way too much, have too much fun and forget to play football. But it clearly doesn't work out very well for them. Lewandowski scored three and missed a penalty. Robben scored one and Ribery scored two, the second of which, the 5-0 goal, is well worth looking up. I think he dribbled most of downtown Hamburg in that goal. That was very, very good. There were some pretty crazy scenes. I hadn't written that down, Max.
was an ad-libbed gag.
That was ad-libbed.
Oh, I like it.
Imagine how...
Yeah. I like how you say that was good. I wonder if you're talking about the goal or the line that you put in.
Definitely the goal. The lines are never good, Max.
Crack on. This
you know that better than most.
Archie Rintel's never be back on again.
After what I said to producer Jonathan earlier, I don't think I'm going to be back every time again. There were pretty crazy scenes in Dortmund because they were 2-0 up against Frankfurt and conceded an equaliser in stoppage time and then scored a winner again deeper into stoppage time with Michy Batshuayi, who was dropped to the bench after a couple of games without scoring, who came on and scored twice. So the batsman doing it there, and that was obviously, given the proximity of the two teams in the table, that was a very big 3 points for Dortmund. Schalke beat Mainz 1-0 to go second, which is impressive because man for man, this is not a great Schalke team. And Domenico Tedesco is doing a very, very good job there. Leverkusen beat Gladbach 2-0 to move to fourth. And RB Leipzig were held to a 0-0 draw to inform Stuttgart, which means RB Leipzig haven't won in their last four games and have dropped to six. Now, Max, if only there was some kind of beverage that you can drink that can give you a boost of energy when things are when it's like winding down a bit, but I can't think of one.
Does everyone hate RB Leipzig because of that?
I think a lot of people don't like them because they're a bit of a sort of soulless construction, but frankly, given the things that are going on in the world of football, if you're going to be a soulless construction, this is not a bad thing to be, because they've gone in an area of Germany where there are a lot of people and there wasn't a top-level football team before. They run the club in the right way, you can say, in the sense they've invested very heavily into the training facilities. Their strategy is signing young players who are on the up rather than sort of throwing money at Brazilian journeymen. And while they're owned by a fizzy drink manufacturer, I mean, I'll take that over a sort of human rights breaching sort of Gulf states. So, I mean, I get why people get exercised about them, because people are very sort of traditionalists in Germany and they seem to fly in the face of everything that German football often thinks it represents. But if you're going to break all of those norms, this is a very good way of doing it.
Is it because they have tried to break the 51?
Yeah, they found a very clever way of doing that. Yeah. Like, because they have this rule that the fans always have to own a small majority in every club. And the way RB Leipzig have done that is that they just have very, very few people having stakes in the club. So they've been very sneaky, which is, again, they're breaking sort of traditional values. But then again, there are holes in that logic as well, because Wolfsburg and Leverkusen are owned privately because they're historical exceptions, so described. So I think I completely get why, if you're a German football fan and you're a fan of one of the other clubs, you really can't stand Leipzig and what they represent. But if we compare them to a lot of other ownership structures and a lot of things and the way modern football has gone and where the money tends to come from, I will take Leipzig over a lot of other clubs.
Okay, is that it from the kebab shop? Can I go to the boulangerie now? Yeah,
never to return.
Okay. Vielen Dank, Herr Sivertsen. To the boulangerie now. Sixth of the top 7-1 in Liga. Rennes, the odd one out, so they were held at home to Saint-Étienne. Trouble continues at Lille, who are now six games without a win. Their fans invaded the pitch at the end of a 1-1 draw with Montpellier. Some even attacked their own players. The LFP will be looking into that matter on Thursday. It could cost Lille just a point from safety as it stands, a points deduction or a ban for the home fans. Not what they need in their bid for survival. And 20-year-old Christopher Nkuku scored two as PSG won 5-0. They stay 14 points clear at the top. Would anybody like some pleasant owner news from Greece? The clash between PAOK and AEK had to be suspended due to a pitch invasion by fans, and the home side's president, Ivan Savidis, he went on to remonstrate with the referee with a gun fastened to his belt. The match official, Georgios Kominis, ruled out a goal by PAOK in the dying minutes of the match, which led to chaotic scenes. Kominis quickly left the pitch along with his colleagues after being threatened by Savidis. AEK Spanish coach Manolo Jimenez told Spanish radio that Savidis went up to the referee, showed him his gun, and said, "Your career as a referee has ended."
Yes. So, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, RB Leipzig's owners.
Exactly right. I mean,
it's not the worst.
Well,
that's not. There's more to that game as well, because Payok had been deducted points for an incident involving when they played Olympiacos that were then given back to them just before kickoff, and the game was supposed to have been played in front of an empty stadium, and they decided very near to kickoff that fans were allowed to go in as well. So just another sort of regular Sunday in the Greek League.
Yeah, sounds incredibly well organised. I can't remember which ex-player I was chatting to about the Greek League where they just said the fixtures just weren't, when he was there, the fixtures weren't, it was like 3 weeks in advance you'd find out who you're playing. Ridiculous.
Many years ago, Mickey Quinn went over and played there, and I think he lasted about three quarters of a season, and he said it was just insane. I think he was in getting a lift off the owner of his team he played for, and his owner had a gun and cash in the front seat, and he just said this is just like nothing else.
How did you say? I said Pauk. What did you say?
I think I said Payok.
Okay.
I think Andy Brassel says Pauk, and that's it must be true.
There you go. If you want to abuse Mark, feel free. The MLS is back. We missed the opening weekend. David Villa scored as New York City FC beat LA Galaxy 2-1. Ashley Cole was sent off in that game. Bradley Wright Phillips scored for the New York Red Bulls in a 4-0 win over Portland. Atlanta United broke the MLS attendance record with 72,000.
Great game as well. They're a fun team to watch, Atlanta, if you find the time. Check out Miguel Almiron's goal there. It was very, very good. It was the 2-0 goal, I believe. They're a cracking side going forward. MLS is a really fun team to league to watch, I think, a lot of the time. The quality sort of varies a little bit, but games are very often fun and eventful.
You're on the payroll for the MLS,
though. No, I just really like it because it's like I'm quite a nocturnal person. Oh, okay. I don't like going to bed at reasonable hours. And thankfully, I've sort of stumbled into a career that allows me the opportunity to not go to bed at reasonable hours. So in the evening, when the football is over, you're kind of a bit sad because you kind of wish there was more football. And then kaboom, like the MLS is on.
Do you? I mean, I must admit, once I've watched how many, you know, there's a certain number of games I can watch before I've got to watch Crufts. That's what I ended up watching yesterday.
I have an actual dog that I can walk, so I go walk the dog if I need a bit of, you know.
Well, I understand that,
but also I should mention the Norwegian League kicked off this weekend, which is not interesting in itself except for the fact that it is way too early for that sort of thing to be happening. So there was snow at a number of the games, and one had to be stopped halfway through the first half so they can get the tractors out to clear the snow.
But they carried on.
Yeah, after a break where there was one, and at one point I think there were two tractors involved with trying to clear the snow off the pitch, and they did actually manage to finish the game. And obviously not good conditions for football almost anywhere. One of the games had to be postponed. And Rosenborg playing Sarpsborg in what could turn out to be a top of the league clash that had been scheduled for the first round of the season when there was almost certainly going to be terrible weather. So well done, Norwegian FA. And in general, it was a bit of a farce.
In Feedback Corner, on Monday we discovered that Jonathan Wilson has a spreadsheet of the episodes of Silent Witness that he has seen and hasn't seen because he wants to watch all of them and hasn't missed one. Doesn't want to watch one twice. Dork 1000, interesting name for what they say, says, "I'm with you, Jonathan. I have a list of Columbo episodes I've watched so I can watch them all and make sure I don't waste time watching any twice." And on Columbo, the former Spurs and Liverpool and Man City centre forward Paul Stewart says that when he looks at Super Sunday and he says, if it's not going to be any good, he just binge watches Columbo instead and finds out the scores.
Are we 100% certain that Dork 1000 isn't actually Jonathan Wilson?
Oh, well, that's a good point. Alexander says, bit late to the party. I was listening to Monday's Football Weekly. I thought I'd see, we were trying to work out how many siblings had played for the same team, and then I mentioned that Barry, there have been five Van Dykes in one episode of Diagnosis Murder. Anyway, Alexander went on to whatever it is, IMDb, to find out how many Van Dykes have an acting credit in Diagnosis Murder. Nine Van Dykes.
And they could all do a better job on Lukaku.
Well, that'll do for today. Thank you for your time, Greg.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Lars.
All good.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Max.
We're back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.